This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Rosa DeLauro says John Pelto should get out of the race for governor, but if he's not careful, he might not even get onto the ballot. Meanwhile, the Republican primary is just 1 week away, and John McKinney is rolling out some plans of what he'd do while governor, and Tom Foley is talking about a new direction when he's governor. I know you're shocked also, but Joe Maturo, East Haven's mayor, is back in hot water. Those are just a few of the stories that we will tackle today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We'll also ask, is it really possible that two of our state's biggest cities are two of the unfriendliest places in the entire country? Yes, we'll take a look at that later on. We're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining us is Chris Keating. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Hartford Courant. Chris, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, John.
And Christine Stewart is here. She is editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hello, John.
And joining us by phone for this first segment is Neil Vigdor, who writes about state politics for the Hearst, Connecticut Media Group. Hello, Neil.
Hi, John. Good to be with you.
So we're going to start with kind of the big news of the day. It is a very important day in this gubernatorial election. It's the date in which the petitioning candidates, the ones we know as John Pelto and Joe Visconti, need to have all their signatures in. And there's this kind of unusual system that we're going to describe throughout the course of this first segment. But I guess I'll ask you first, Colin, as we arrive at this date, we've been talking for quite some time like it seems obvious that John Pelto is going to get on the ballot. And we're wondering about whether or not he's going to get into all of the debates. And it seems to us a long shot maybe that Joe Visconti will get onto the ballot. Well, from what they're telling people like Chris and Christine, it seems that might be the other way around.
Right, although in a second, Chris will give you his very amusing theory about why Joe Visconti may be somewhat over-optimistic. But Joe Visconti is now sending signals that he's pretty much there. In other words, he's got a margin to spare. The 7,500 signatures is what's required. It is an incredibly complicated process. And, in fact, the signatures have to be submitted to the town hall from which the signer originates. They also ultimately have to be verified by the Secretary of State as well, and on kind of two different bases. So you have to sign, you have to close your eyes, you spin around three times, you make a wish. That may be Build-A-Bear. I get the two of them mixed up a little bit.
I don't think that's right, but it could be right.
It's very complicated. And the signatures, and one thing that I was discovering last night, I was in communication with a town clerk who didn't know the rule that that these petitions have to be double-sided. So, I mean, the town clerks don't know the rules that the Secretary of State has to follow. In CT News Junkie today, well, I'll let Christine say how John Pelto is concerned that people are being disqualified incorrectly. It's a very, very messy system. The one other thing I will just quickly say, though, is I'll ask all of us to just close our eyes and go back and remember one of the great political strategists of modern life, Mike Jarjura, who at one point, somehow or other, despite being the incumbent mayor of Waterbury, had to run as a write-in candidate, which doesn't happen to incumbents very often. But you know what he did? His entire campaign was about one thing: how to do a write-in vote. There was his ads, everything. The whole campaign was how to do a write-in vote, and it works. And it worked for him. And I just don't really notice John Pelto doing the work right now to explain to people that, among other things, they can actually print the petitions out themselves and make them double-sided and blah, 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 and just hand them into their own town clerks. And he really should be focusing. You should be able to go on his website, and the first thing you see is that. And in fact, you know, Visconti has done, I think, this a little bit better, a little bit quicker to educate his own constituency about how to do this.
Well, Colin, I'm sorry, before I get to you, Christine, what's on the other side? Why does it need to be two sides? What's on the second side?
There's the signatures are on one side, and there's something else. I forget what's on the other side. I think it's a treasure map, but I'm not. I forget what's
I really am
the
interested
side.
In what's on the second side.
But I'm not sure what's on the second
it's
side.
It's a disclosure for your credit card.
What's interesting is that it includes on the form where you sign, you have to sign your name, print your name, and include your date of birth. But under state statute, some of these are being disqualified because there was no date of birth. The date of birth helps the registrar and local officials validate the signature. Mm-hmm. But under state statutes, it's not required.
So you don't have to give your date of birth by state statute, but there's a chance that some of these are being disqualified because the date of birth isn't on there.
Correct. And so that's kind of where Jonathan stands right now. I think 10% of the ballots that have been submitted so far for his campaign have been disqualified. What I thought was really interesting and smart of Joe Visconti to do was that he went to every town where there was a referendum or a special election, you know, budget referendums happening in May and all that. And so those were voters he knew had already been qualified to vote because they were leaving a polling place. And so he stood outside and had them sign his petition, which was pretty smart.
That actually sounds like a pretty smart idea. And so what he's saying to us right now, Chris, is that he has already collected over 10,000 signatures, and 7,500 is the barrier. But he wants to collect even more to make sure that he is indeed well over this threshold, because, as we understand, some will probably be thrown out, rightly or wrongly. John Pelto is a little bit short of that. Do you buy Joe Visconti's numbers here, 10,000 signatures plus?
Well, one thing you have to remember, as Colin was saying, it is a crazy, wacky Byzantine system. The main thing you need to know is if you're outside Stop and Shop and you get 10 people in a row and they're from 10 different towns, you need 10 separate pieces of paper from those 10 different towns, right, or else they're not going to count. It's a crazy system. So, in other words, you literally have to have the papers in front of you from A to Z and over to Wethersfield, to Windsor, to everything. And you must sign. If you live in Wethersfield, you can only sign on the piece of paper that says Wethersfield. So when you're at Stop and Shop, you're never going to get 10 people in a row who say, yeah, I'm all from Hartford. Second right. point, if Visconti is outside gun shops, okay, and which is what he was doing, some guy coming in from Massachusetts, the first thing he's going to say is, oh, yeah, I'm a registered voter. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Meanwhile, he lives in Massachusetts or who knows where. So the verification process is huge, which is what Christine is talking about. This is not a slam dunk. It's not a slam dunk for either of them.
Neil Vigdor, down in your neck of the woods, what are you seeing around this? Because obviously John Pelto, Joe Visconti can't go to every single town in the state, all 169. Are you hearing anything from Fairfield County residents about this?
Actually, I've been hearing that some Republicans down, particularly in Greenwich, Tom Foley's hometown, have been trying to help circulate petitions to get Pelto qualified for the general election in the hopes that he's going to siphon votes away from Governor Malloy. And certainly, you know, we've been through this whole process before with Mark Loretti, the first electman, the mayor of Shelton, who tried to get on the ballot as Mark Bouton's running mate for the gubernatorial race and wasn't able to reach the threshold. And Chris is right. You know, it is a very kind of Byzantine process. There is no provision. If I bring in a petition to the Greenwich Registrar and it has somebody from New Canaan on it, they can't give that petition to their colleague or their counterpart in New Canaan.
Well,
those names are just being thrown out.
And that's what I just wanted to quickly say, that's, Colin, I think what you were talking about, though, too, is at the town registrar level, at the town clerk level, it's not entirely clear that everyone knows what the rules are, what to do. I think going in, we learned from John Pelto that he wasn't entirely sure what he needed to do as far as what he could send to the Secretary of the State's office, what he could actually had to send to the town. We've spoken at quite some length about the difficulties for third-party or petitioning candidates in the state. It's almost impossible to get this big old pile of state money that is now available to run a campaign. So even if they get on the ballot, they won't have any money to run. And now this seems to really shed some light on yet another system that makes it almost impossible for anybody who's not an endorsed candidate as a Republican or an endorsed candidate for Democrat to win anything in the state.
It's harder than it needs to be. And the question is it harder than it needs to be by accident? I mean, they just sort of made up all these rules and didn't think too much about how it would be to try to live under them? Or is it harder than it needs to be on purpose because the powers that be have no interest in opening up this process? I mean, obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, Democrats right now are very not interested in seeing John Pelto prosper, and any more than Tom Foley and his people are interested in seeing Joe Visconti prosper and get on the ballot and be part of debates and stuff like that. I think, and I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to that question, but I think we do know the answer to the question, why don't they fix it? Or will they fix it? They have no incentive to fix it. It's a process that should be streamlined. I don't think you'll see a bill in the legislature next year to do that.
And that is probably right. If you have thoughts on this, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you have some questions about the way the system is working, about whether or not we will see third-party candidates on the ballot in November, we're talking with Colin McEnroe, Chris Keating from The Current, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Neil Vigdor from the Hearst Connecticut Media Group. One quick thing I just want to ask you about, Chris, is amongst the chorus of people either saying to John Pelto, get out, or I'm not going to sign your petition, or don't sign John Pelto's petition on the Democratic side. We hear from Rosa DeLauro even now. It seems as though almost everyone, for the most part, in the Democratic establishment has lined up, although some members, as you write in the newspaper, of the Connecticut delegation have sort of stepped back and said, well, let's let this play out. Let's make sure that whoever wants to get on the ballot can, and I support Dan Malloy. Do you take anything from Rosa DeLauro actually coming out and saying, no, this is not John Pelto's time?
Yeah, that is correct. Our intern, Matt Clarida, talked to Rosa yesterday, and yeah, Rosa was the only one who flat out said Pelto doesn't belong in the race. Blumenthal basically came out and said, look, it's American democracy. You have a right to petition onto the ballot. Tony Harp said the same thing. Chris Murphy said the same thing. Generally, the Democratic view, Democratic capital D, small d, is, hey, everyone's got a right to run. In other words, if you get these petitions, you should be able to be on it. But Rosa said it's not his time. It's not his time. Pelto should not be running.
It's
okay?
Not his time, Christine.
Well, I'm just curious as to what they're saying behind closed doors. You know, are the unions who are supporting Malloy telling their members, your name better not show up on one of those petitions because, you know, God forbid it does, and you're going to be in big trouble. And we'll never know. I mean, nothing that they're private organizations.
Well, one thing I just want to ask, though, because you're talking to people around the state all the time about this. Yes, it's a complicated system, and yes, he may or may not get the number of signatures. Does it say anything about what the actual support is? I mean, I think that we've assumed a certain amount of support for John Pelto, given his strong opposition of Governor Malloy's education policies, about the fact that there's clearly tens of thousands, at least, of disaffected teachers who may not step forward and vote in one way or the other, but clearly have had their minds changed by some of John Pelto's writings. Do you get any sense of what the actual support for him or for Joe Visconti really is in the state, Christine?
Well, I mean, I think if you look back to 2010, we had Tom Marsh, who was the first selectman of Chester, who got 17,000 votes in that race. So, you know, I would say Jonathan probably has a higher profile than Tom Marsh did and, you know, possibly double that. So, I don't know. 35,000.
I would say to your listeners, please call in if you've heard of Tom Marsh. Please call in the next 10 minutes.
Well, you can. 860-275-7266. But that's maybe the point. That's 17,000 votes, and that's way more than the number that Tom Foley lost to Dan Malloy by, 6,000-some votes, Colin McAro. I mean, this actually matters how much real support John Pelto has.
Yeah, I think you also have to sort of factor for the way people are unhappy now. I mean, people might have been not super enthusiastic about their choices 4 years ago. People are really unhappy, and there are a lot of unhappy people who don't seem to want to vote for either one of the major party candidates. And I don't think that you can look at the difficulty Pelto is having right now with his petition as a sign of his support. I mean, a lot of it has to do with whether you went to Big Y or Stop and Shop on a certain day, you know, and people don't know how to affirmatively go and help him now. And there's a lot of people who would probably vote for him if he were on a ballot who also are not going to spend their Tuesday running around trying to figure out how to get a signature on a petition form. Those are sort of two different levels of support.
So, of course, we're going to find out more about that today, although with all the counting and recounting that has to happen, we may not actually know if either of these two gentlemen get on the ballot for another couple weeks. What we do know is that next week, 1 week from today, there is this Republican primary. And Neil Victor, I know that you've been writing about what the turnout may be expected to be. It's summertime. The living is kind of easy. People are on vacation or just getting back from vacation. What are we seeing as far as a possible turnout for this very important Republican primary?
Well, I think that kind of the benchmark is, four years ago when Tom Foley and then Lieutenant Governor Michael Fedeli faced off in a very bitter GOP primary. The turnout was about 30% then. If you talk to the Secretary of the State's office, they feel like it's going to be sub 30%. There definitely seems to be less juice this time for the primary than there was 4 years ago. And again, this is kind of rekindling the argument of why are we having this primary in August, and should Connecticut consider maybe having a June primary or going to the spring? 2004 was when the law changed in Connecticut, but since then, and it kind of undercuts the argument of changing the primary date. 2006 was kind of the gold standard with Ned Lamont and Joe Lieberman in the Democratic Senate primary, when you had 46% of Democrats turning out for that. So it's expected to be light.
But I think it also speaks, and whenever we talk about 2006, it speaks, Christine, to the fact that there was indeed a historic campaign. It was about a very important issue that everyone in America, not just in Connecticut, was talking about, and it had very strong personalities and an upstart quality, and that's an entirely different thing than, you know, Tom Foley and John McKinney, two guys, one of whom about half the state knows who he is, and one of whom not enough people of the state know who he is, even though he is the state Senate minority leader. I just don't see, as Neil says, the juice for this particular this primary actually get all that many people out there.
Yeah, and that was a U.S. Senate primary. So, you know, this is the governor's race. And this year there is, you know, no U.S. Senate race on the ticket. The senators are safe for another few years, I guess. So I think that's part of it. You know, the issue with Iraq, it was the war in Iraq that was the big issue in 2006, and that was exciting. And, you know, Joe Lieberman was already a national figure, and he was being challenged by, you know, the startup who...
Well, and I think that's important. So it's a Senate race. It's much different than a governor's race. I mean, what do you expect as far as turnout, Chris?
Well, Neil has had some good history numbers there. I had written an article a while back. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. But the August numbers, at least, as he said, the numbers changed in 2004 when the law changed. It was relatively similar to when the primaries were in September. In other words, I know everyone says everyone's at the beach, they're at the Cape, they're here and there. But the turnout numbers were relatively similar. So I don't necessarily know or say that, hey, just switch it to September or whenever you want to switch it to, and suddenly there'll be an explosion in turnout.
You know, one thing, Colin, I just have to say, we're talking about weird little rules and things, something I guess I didn't know. Unaffiliated voters and those not yet registered can actually vote in this primary if they enroll as a Republican by August 11th, meaning that if you'd wanted to switch your party affiliation in order to vote in this primary, you would have had to do it months and months ago. But if you're unaffiliated, and there's a lot of unaffiliated voters in Connecticut, you can actually basically almost do Election Day registration.
Yeah, and, you know, it points up a whole bunch of different things. But, yes, it's really hard to switch your party. If you're a Democrat, you want to vote in the Republican primary. There's this long cooling off period. You have to figure out that you want to do that long before there are actually some candidates to think about. But for unaffiliateds, yeah. And you know, if one thing to think about the Republicans is there aren't that many of them, which makes these primaries even more fluky. In other words, you only have about 400,000 voters total. It makes these primaries even a little bit more fluky. What I don't understand – we were talking about this a couple of days ago. Well, I do understand it. But, you know, the Republicans put themselves in this very difficult position. So there's about 800,000 and change unaffiliated voters, about 700,000 and change Democratic voters, about 400,000, give or take, Republicans. So – you know, you really need those unaffiliated voters. If you're a Republican, you really have to put a lot of unaffiliated voters together with your base to win. But the primary that they do, you know, why they don't want to include those people in an open primary and have an open primary, I mean, the primary that they do winds up selecting a nominee who's appealing only to that very tiny base, which may not ultimately be in their best interest.
How do we get to an open primary here? Is it simply a party issue? Does it have to go through the legislature?
Chris put his hand up.
Well, they switched it around. When Lowell Weicker was in there, Weicker had a lot of appeal to the unaffiliated. So the party, the Republican Party, literally did switch the rule so that unaffiliated, which is what Colin's talking about, could vote in the Republican primary. As soon as Weicker got bounced out of there and Tom DeMoor got bounced out of there and Roland came in, they switched it back to the way that it was. And so right now, today, as we speak, the unaffiliated, unless you switch, cannot vote.
But it's a party issue. It's not a correct. It's not a state statute issue.
So it seems maybe as though this is something that the parties could take up and think about. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the new campaign ads that are out there in this race for governor. Of course, the primary happens next week, and November is what we're all looking forward to. I want to thank Neil Vigdor, who writes about state politics for Hearst Connecticut Media. Thanks so much, Neil. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Have a great day, everybody.
And we're also here with Christine Stewart. She's the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Chris Keating, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Hartford Current. And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. You can join us with your thoughts about this governor's race, 860-275-7266. And this is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so that means The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Talking about the news with us this week is Christine Stort from CTNewsJunkie.com, Chris Keating from The Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What is happening on the show today at 1 o'clock, Colin?
Well, 40 years ago, we were sort of in the last throes of Watergate. The resignation was coming up in just a few days. So we're going to take that trip back in time and talk a little bit about Watergate with the son of Patrick Gray from Stonington, the FBI chief, Thomas Mallon, who decided the best way to write about this was in the form of a novel, and Michael Schutzen, a historian who studies collective memory, the way that societies remember history as opposed to the bare facts of it.
I'm really interested in the collective memory piece of this. That's excellent. So Colin McEnroe talking Watergate, 1 o'clock this afternoon here on WNPR. If you want to join us as we talk about the race for governor, 860-275-7266. I just want to get to a quick phone call from Teddy, who's calling from East Haven, before we go to some other stuff. Hi, Teddy. Go ahead.
Hi, John. I was listening, and I think that Connecticut does make lots of things complicated. But if I want a job, it's my responsibility to find out how I get it, what's required, and if I can meet the qualifications. These are grown men, all of whom supposedly have governmental experience of some kind. There is no excuse for not knowing what you have to do.
Teddy, I think you make a really good point. But you said before Connecticut does make an awful lot of things complicated. I mean, do you think that we make it unduly complicated for third-party candidates, not just to get on the ballot, but to get some of the public financing that we now have as part of our system? It seems as though the Republicans and Democrats have figured out a way to make sure that there's not a whole lot of challenges here.
I think that's very true. I think we are still in a pioneer mode, and you're one or the other. We don't have a broad range of appreciation for what other people can bring to the table.
Teddy, thank you so much for your phone call. I want to get to Fred, who's calling from the car. Fred, go ahead.
Hi. A couple questions for Colin about some comments he wrote on Facebook last night about Jonathan Pelto.
Mm-hmm.
Does he think Dan Malloy is a bad governor or just a bad candidate? And then second, I didn't quite understand the thing about people printing out their own petitions for Jonathan Pelto and bringing it to the registrar. Do you just need one name, or do you have to fill the whole thing out with names for him? So that's it. Thanks very much.
All right.
Thanks,
so
Fred.
Let me do the second part first. And don't go by me, all right? I'm not a town clerk. I'm not. But my understanding of this, and I think it's backed up by the other two people here on the panel, is yes, you can print out the petition, make sure it's double-sided, print out the petition, make sure it comes out double-sided. You can even sort of tape the two, you know, you can sort of double back the
We're
tape.
We're on CTN right now, and I'm literally slapping my forehead.
Yeah, I mean,
anyway,
make sure you do that. Then take it, you and your spouse or whoever, I mean, you don't have to fill it up. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no minimum amount of signatures you have to have. So, no, you can just fill it out and take it to the town hall. What I said last night on Facebook, in perhaps an intemperate moment, is, you know, because somebody was saying to me, well, obviously doesn't Pelto appearing on the ballot throw the election to Foley? And I just said, you know, they're all kind of bad candidates in a way. I mean, I think Foley has shown himself to be inept in ways that we discussed last week. Dan Malloy, to be an incumbent governor and to have the registration margin that I just talked about in the previous segment, you know, roughly 700,000 and change to 400,000 and change to your opponent, and to be worried about a threat as tiny as John Pelto indicates in a way that he has not been a successful politician. I mean, the position he finds himself in, no matter which poll you believe, suggests that he is not a successful politician in the state of Connecticut. He may eke out this election, but I don't think you can really say that he's done a really good job of positioning himself with the voters.
And when you say which poll do you believe, is it the online poll that has Tom Foley up by 9 points, or is it some other generic polling that might suggest that these two are neck and neck? At this point, should an incumbent governor who's done some of the things that he's been able to do, Chris Keating, should he be able to count on more than just this tiny little bit of cushion, or maybe even be running from behind?
Well, you would assume that. I think a big thing will be who has the better turnout the vote operation. That's going to be huge. I think there's a perception out there. It's true, the online poll, there was a lot of questions about it. It probably is a dead heat right around now. In other words, if you did a poll yesterday, it's 36-35. It's 35-34. But I think it's a within the margin of error dead heat. And the answer, the final answer could be who turns out the votes better than the other person.
And do we have much of a sense about what the ground game is for Tom Foley and as far as turning out the votes, Christine? I mean, we know a little bit about the Democratic machine that is the state that will be working on behalf of Governor Malloy. What about Tom Foley?
Well, I think Tom Foley, there's a Republican primary first, so we shouldn't say that. Tom Foley is definitely going to be the one
That's
to go
true.
On to challenge Governor Malloy. There's also John McKinney, who keeps getting left out of all these polls. But, you know, Tom Foley has thrown his support and some of his staff members overlap with the Republican Party. And he was the one who brought New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in to fundraise for the Republican Party. Last week. So he is trying to create the synergy between his campaign and the Republican Party and whatever ground game they have.
He brought in yet another really likable guy, another likable character,
yeah.
Someone who's not divisive at all to stump for votes.
But he is head of the Republican Governors Association, so that also does come with money.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to hear
from money.
We're going to hear from some of these ads that have been coming out this weekend. We were going to start with the Governor Malloy ad, but since we're talking about Tom Foley, let's listen to a little bit from Tom Foley's brand new ad that I think he just rolled out yesterday.
No matter where you live in Connecticut, things can be better. But things won't get better with the same old policies and politicians in charge. We need a different direction.
So, Colin, this is an ad in which he's walking into the frame in various locations across the state. He's wearing what is now sort of a trademark sweater over an open-collared shirt. And he starts by walking through a place that looks like it has graffiti all over the walls. It's maybe a rundown neighborhood in one of our urban areas. But the graffiti is actually pro-Tom Foley graffiti, which I thought was an unusual idea. And his whole new idea is Connecticut needs a change. It's just going in the wrong direction. What do you think of this ad?
First of all, Chris Christie tagged a lot of stuff while he was here.
So that's what it is.
That could have been. That's just something he does. First of all, that obviously is going to be one of his fundamental arguments. Why wouldn't it be? I mean,
sure.
He's running a standard challengers campaign. In this case, he has his own internal polling and the polling that we can actually lay our eyes on to tell us that, yeah, there are high levels of dissatisfaction with the way things are, which has not been unusual in Connecticut over the last couple of decades, and you know, high unfavorables for the incumbent governor. So, yeah, why not run that ad?
Why not run that ad? And I think even where he starts out, there's sort of at least a hint, Chris Keating, at this idea that Tom Foley is going to talk somewhat about our cities, that the cities matter to Tom Foley, even though he's not a cities guy. He didn't pay attention to them so much last campaign. Is that actually part of what he's trying to say?
Yes, it's definitely true. His election night party is in Waterbury, believe it or not. It's not at a Greenwich Country Club. I know Neil's not on the line anymore, but yeah, it's in Waterbury. And he announced, I guess he announced his exploratory committee that was in Bridgeport. I went to that. Normally, same thing. You would think maybe it'd be a Greenwich Town Hall, et cetera, et cetera. None of that has been there. Yes, he's trying to concentrate on the cities, but he will admit, if you talk to him, he's not going to win the cities. What you have to do is just keep the margins down and not get blown out. He got blown out last time in New Haven, for example, and he got blown out in Hartford. So, in other words, if I'll make up a number. It probably obviously wouldn't be that close. But if you lose 60-40 in Hartford, it's better than losing 90-10. So you have to avoid being blown out. It's almost like a negative strategy, if I'm explaining it well to you.
Well, but of course, one of the issues in Hartford is even if you lost 90-10, that would be 90 votes for one guy and 10 votes for the other guy. It's part of the problem in the urban areas anyway, Christine. We don't have a huge voter turnout. I mean, do you think Tom Foley actually makes some inroads in the cities? You know, closes that gap a little bit?
You know, I don't know what the Republican voter registration is in Hartford, I think we know the guy.
I think he might call in.
Rich Waring, I think.
Yeah, it's Rich Waring.
He can call in. He knows Tom Marsh, so whoever that person is, call in.
Well, I think it was the last Republican primary in New Haven where some turkeys and just one guy showed up to a polling place. Mm-hmm. So the registrars, because Governor Malloy vetoed this legislation, the registrars actually have to open up all of the polling places no matter what.
Oh, my goodness. So,
you know, there's going to be registrars who are kind of upset sitting around all day where there is not high Republican registration. But in Hartford, we do have a state Senate primary on the Democratic side that's going to draw a lot of attention.
The other ad, you've been saying, Christine, that we're not paying enough attention to John McKinney. John McKinney has a new ad out as well. Let's listen. It's with his running mate, Dave Walker.
Our plan puts taxpayers first by eliminating income taxes of middle-class families, cutting wasteful spending, and shrinking state government.
It's a good plan, an honest plan that will bring major change to Hartford.
So two things about this, Christine. One is, well, he is running with his lieutenant governor candidate, and they are a team. The other thing that we see consistently from John McKinney is he's going to talk about his plan, actual specific things that he's going to do. Tom Foley is going to walk us in a new direction. John McKinney is going to say, here's what I'm going to do. It shows a real difference in the two campaigns.
No, it definitely does. I mean, John McKinney saying, here, this is what I'm going to do with the budget. I'm going to cut spending. There is a deficit. We are going to have to cut spending. I know that my opponent is saying, keep spending flat, but that's not going to cut it. That's not going to get us there. And those specifics are important to some voters. And Tom Foley has been fairly vague, and Tom Foley hasn't – I think the last time he tried to hold a press conference in Sprague, things kind of backfire on him every time he goes and talks to a bunch of reporters at the same time.
We talked about that a little bit last week. That indeed seems to be the case. John McKinney, you've written about this, Colin. He has some specifics. He's talking now specifically about, I want to get rid of the Common Core if I'm governor. This is John Pelto territory. It also may be Joe Visconti territory. It's actually territory of a lot of people right now in the state. But coming out and saying this is how I'm going to change education. This is yet another thing that I think he's using to try to differentiate himself from Tom Foley, who's not really giving us a whole lot of specifics about anything.
There's an expression in baseball. You see when a pitcher up at the plate, you know, and swinging in one of those ways that just corkscrews his whole body. It's swing hard in case you hit it.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of where John McKinney is right now. I mean, he's behind in this race. Internal polling that he may be alluding to, notwithstanding, he's behind in this race. So it makes sense, and he needs to get a thumbprint on the public consciousness. So it makes sense for him to say significant things. He's going to eliminate the income tax for, you know, people making $75,000 or less. He's going to roll back a Common Core entirely. It makes sense for him to say proposals that are very bold and understandable. They're not highly nuanced. That's kind of where the meat is for him right now.
One of the things that I wanted to get to, and before we hear the Dan Malloy ad that just came out this week, of course, there is a race for lieutenant governor. Kevin Rennie in the Hartford Current writing that lieutenant governor pick could make or break the Republican ticket. Here's a little bit from lieutenant governor debate on WFSB's Face the State candidate Heather Summers commented on how the ticket should look.
When you go to the vote on August 12th, please think about what your ticket's going to look like. We can't have two people from the same part of Connecticut on this ticket. We need to have diversity on the ticket. We need to have someone who understands where people are most impacted by government, which is on the local level.
Okay, so does this really matter? We're not spending a whole lot of time talking about who the lieutenant governor candidates are. Obviously, John McKinney has hitched himself to Dave Walker. How much does this really matter to what happens in November, Chris?
Well, they vote, one thing to know, as your listeners know, they vote separately. So you can say that you're on a ticket, but not in the primary. You're really not on a ticket. So you're voting separately, and that's happened multiple times in which the person who was allegedly on the ticket with somebody, one person won, one person lost. Yes, the lieutenant governor is not as in the marquee, but the bottom line, the lieutenant governor, they can hurt you, but they can't help you. If something goes wrong and there's a lot of problems, they can hurt your ticket. It's marginal that they can help your ticket.
But doesn't some, as we hear from Heather Summers here, some geographic diversity, some gender diversity, especially on the Republican side, couldn't it possibly just help to have a ticket that looks a little bit more like Connecticut than, you know, two white guys on the ticket once again, Christine?
So for 25 years, it's been a male and a female lieutenant governor and governor. So Connecticut has chosen to be diverse in choosing its ticket. So I think it was the last time was Bill O'Neill's administration that there were two men in those positions. But it's interesting that you have Penny Bakayaki and Heather Summers, and the two of them seem to be sniping at each other. And David Walker seems to be staying above the fray. And I'm wondering if that will benefit him, and that on primary night we're going to be at a McKinney-Walker victory party where Walker has won and McKinney has lost.
And what that, and the question about November then, Colin, is then what we head into with November is Tom Foley and Dave Walker on a ticket together. And is that the sort of thing that catalyzes enough people to vote Republican as opposed to vote for Dan Malloy and Nancy Wyman?
I think Chris is right that I don't think the lieutenant governors help you very much. I think the first thing that Foley will have to do is coordinate his message with whomever he's running with. Since he has never really embraced or adopted any of these three candidates, he's going to have to coordinate with them. We know that his previous marriage to Mark Boughton was a somewhat rocky one. So, I mean, he's got to get on sound footing anyway with the person he's running with. The other thing that I would just quickly say about this is, you know, the Republican Party's had a lot of trouble developing candidates, which is why Tom Foley runs every year while Linda McMahon runs every year. I mean, just these cycles, we see these people with, you know, a lot of money and not much of a political portfolio running. And I do see this as a little bit of a training ground, particularly Heather Bond Summers, all right? I mean, I think she sees herself as a viable Connecticut politician down the road, whether she wins this thing or not. You know, is up in the air. But I'm guessing you'll hear from her again. And I think that she is using this as kind of a proving ground to sort of see how her message works, how her style works. I think she at least sees herself as a rising star within the party, and she might not be wrong.
The gender balance is important and geographical balance and all that. But just one thing to remember on the national level, when Clinton and Gore got together, two Southern white males, really from the same part of the country, that was supposed to not work, and they won. So it is. Don't get me wrong; the gender balance is important, but there have been times where two people, almost next door in Arkansas and Tennessee, pulled it off. That's national, obviously.
But we're going to take a listen to one more quick ad, and it gets to one of the issues that's just sort of been hanging over the Malloy administration, certainly, and hanging over this campaign for governor. It's a new ad, and it addresses some of the crises that Governor Malloy's had to deal with, including the Newtown shootings.
Governor Malloy has the courage and conviction to stand up and do the right thing.
Dan Malloy has made the tough decisions for our kids and our future.
And picture there is Nicole Hockley, who is one of the most outspoken members of the families of the Sandy Hook shooting victims. She is a survivor, somebody who was on our show not too long ago talking about gun legislation. I'm wondering, Colin, how this strikes you, and I'd like to hear from all of our panelists here. It's one of those questions. How does a governor who had to deal with something so important, and it's such a big part of his legacy, then run ads about it, talk about it on the campaign trail? He almost can't not. He can't do it. He can't not do it. How does this strike you?
Well, I think his first ad, which was a pastiche of issues but cited the moment when evil ran through the halls of a public school, struck a lot of people, including me, as an attempt to politicize something that maybe shouldn't be politicized. I think the answer to it is this ad. In other words, you can't tell Nicole Hockley that she can't politicize it. She has every right, every moral right, every personal right to behave as she wants to and to ally herself with whomever she wants to. So in some ways, I think this ad does neutralize the criticism a bit that Malloy shouldn't use this as kind of a Sandy Hook as a political tool.
And that's exactly what she's done in this very public tangle with Chris Christie over New Jersey gun legislation that she was very outspoken about. Nicole Hockley has indeed been someone who can speak about that. And she is used in this ad as someone who is identified with this event, but the event isn't talked about. Any thoughts on your mind, Christine, about how this is used?
Well, and we're told by the Malloy campaign that she, you know, approached them and she wanted to offer her help and she wanted to do whatever she could to help his election efforts. You know, so Chris Healy, the former Republican chairman, says, you know, it is a fine line. I mean, is it politicizing a tragedy?
Yeah. Chris?
Yes, it is very, very touchy. I would compare it to 9/11. It all depends on how close you were to it. A lot of people after 9/11, depending if you had friends who died in the towers, et cetera, had a totally different reaction to it and couldn't really read books about it for years or things of that nature. So it's a touchy thing, and Newtown is not even 2 years old. So it's a touchy thing, and different people react to it in different ways.
We're talking in the wheelhouse today about some of the news of the week. When we come back, we're going to turn to some town politics. Joe Maturo, who is the mayor of East Haven, is back in the news once again. We're going to take some of your calls on that as well and bring in Evan Lips, who's a reporter for the New Haven Register. We just got word that Tom Foley sent out an email to supporters with the subject line, "Where do I vote?" Well, you're going to be voting in the Republican primary, some of you, next week at this time, and we'll have the results on next week's wheelhouse. For now, we're going to take a break and come right back. We'll be right back. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow we broadcast live from the White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield. We're going to be celebrating the center's 50th anniversary. We'll learn about the sprawling parks, habitats, and hiking trails, and many programs. We'll visit with the center's collection of native critters. Yes, we're going to have live owls, bats, and snakes on the program tomorrow. That's happening live at the White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield, one of my favorite places in the entire world, and I hope you can join us there on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined in the studio by Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Chris Keating from the Hartford Current, and Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. I want to bring in Evan Lips. He's a reporter for the New Haven Register to talk about a story that, well, he's back in the news. Joe Maturo, the mayor of East Haven, he, of course, oversees a town whose police force was the subject of civil rights complaints and a settlement. He made national headlines talking about tacos and the town's Hispanic population. Now a town hall secretary has filed a sexual harassment complaint against him. There's a Family and Medical Leave Act complaint against him. And there's a big question in newsrooms like ours about how he went about outing the woman who made the complaints. Evan Lips, welcome back to the show. Maybe you can tell us first what the complaints are and how you found out about them.
Good morning, John. The complaint, with him, it was something he would say to her, and obviously this was not G-rated stuff, according to her, and word gets out in that town. That's all I can say. Like, if you have a few sources on the ground, you find out about things pretty quickly, and this came to me Thursday morning, and everything turned around, and I was as shocked as anybody when I got an email after I'd been asking, containing the full complaint and the mayor's statement with no redactions of this woman's name.
And so just to be clear, normally in something like this, that's the sort of thing you might try to find out as a reporter, but often, almost all the time, the names of someone who files a complaint like this would be redacted. It wouldn't be available. But you're saying that the mayor's office just put this stuff right out there to the press, including you.
Yeah, they did. I got the email from Town Hall just before 5, and it was, basically confirmed everything I heard. And then 10 minutes later, they blasted it out to the rest of the state, which I thought was kind of surprising as well.
It was surprising. And Colin, it set off a big conversation in our newsroom about how you deal with information like this. We spend a lot of time talking about freedom of information, wanting to get all the information we can and let the public make up their minds. This is a case where when someone files a sexual harassment complaint, normally we would be very cautious about putting somebody's name out there.
Yeah, we actually did have a very long and almost Aristotelian conversation about how to deal with this. Let me just sort of say one thing about all this first. I mean, obviously, my feelings about Joe Maturo darken with each new chapter of his professional career, and I feel as though he will be judged severely at some point in his life, although apparently not by the electorate of East Haven for his behavior. On the other hand, the one thing that I did think a little bit about over the weekend is, imagine that a complaint like that were filed against me and I believed I was innocent. I might actually want the complainant to have to own this and to not be able to file the complaint against me on an anonymous basis. And there is no rule, as far as I know, that says that he can't do this. In other words, the CHRO, the commission itself, cannot divulge these names. But either side can divulge the names. And so he decided to do this. It seemed like, as so many things that Joe Maturo does, a very unappetizing, bullying way to deal with a problem. But I feel like there is at least sort of another side to this story.
Evan, I'm wondering what the take is around town, because as Colin said, this is a guy who, despite all the bad press, the intemperate things that he said, and the problems with the police force, he does get elected. He does have a lot of support in town. How are people reacting to these allegations?
Well, I'll give you an example. Last night was a town council meeting, and the topic was a 911 center, and this issue never came up once. Nobody talked about it. The mayor was there. Nobody asked him about it. People around town, obviously, when this came out, were quite shocked. But there is a large group of folks who claim that this woman is making this up, and that the reason she is doing so is like he said in his statement, is that she was on the verge of termination. Now, I've looked into that, and the reason why they wanted to fire her is because of a lot of absences, and that does not include the FMLA leave she was on, which coincidentally, on FMLA leave, you have 12 weeks, I believe, up to 12 weeks, And she received a letter on July 28th telling her to come back, and that's when her leave expired. That was also the same day that the town received a letter from her via CHRO naming them this complaint. So the timing is everything, I guess.
Chris Keating?
Yeah, I just wanted to say in some of these cases, it depends on the fact pattern. I've seen some of these cases where the name came out and other cases where it didn't come out. And I've covered court cases where it's filed, you know, Jane Doe against so-and-so. And the defense comes in and says to the judge that this shouldn't be allowed to be filed under Jane Doe. And there's a big fight about that. And then the judge can rule on that. So all I'm saying is sometimes the names do come out in these cases.
Well, there is now also a federal lawsuit that was filed the other day by this woman against the town of East Haven, alleging that they violated her family and medical leave that she did take. And she took because her daughter was deathly ill in the hospital. And during the family medical leave, apparently she was getting text messages from people in town hall, you know, begging her to come back. When are you going to come back to work? And she couldn't leave her daughter's side.
Not exactly begging, too. I mean, basically saying the mayor's going to be here pretty soon. I don't want to have to deal with this. I mean, the person sending the text was not exactly threatening her, but suggesting that there was somebody else who would effectively be threatening her. And it certainly did. I mean, if you want a hostile work environment, this didn't sound like any place that I've ever worked. Usually when you have a relative, a daughter who's deathly ill, everybody says, you know, do what you need to do. We'll cover for you. This was pretty clearly the opposite of that.
Hey, and just very quickly, Evan Lips, of course, the mayor has essentially said, as part of putting out all this information, I didn't do the things that are alleged in the sexual harassment complaint.
Right, right. Well, the interesting thing about this, and if you were paying attention and you read through the complaint, John Williams, the attorney, told me this again, is that some of these things that he did were made in the presence of others, including Police Chief Brent Larrabee and town attorney Joe Zullo, these allegations. So if that is true, those guys will likely, I'm not sure how this works. Will they be subpoenaed? I don't know.
Well, Evan Lips, who is a reporter for the New Haven Register, he covers East Haven. He's talked with us before about Joe Maturo. Good to talk to you once again, Evan. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, John. Thank you.
As we run low on time, I wanted to mention just something that I saw in the Hartford Current online today. Hartford, New Haven, are now rated by Condé Nast Traveler. It's the travel magazine that a lot of people use when they're going to go find places that they want to travel. The Reader's Choice Survey asked readers to rate a city's friendliness, and travelers ranked both New Haven and Hartford amongst the unfriendliest cities in the U.S., with the Elm City coming in fifth and the capital city, Hartford, ranking third. The only cities less friendly than Hartford, according to the survey, are Oakland, California, and Newark, New Jersey, which claimed the top spot. Does this sound right? We see these things, Colin. These surveys don't, I don't think, mean a lot. But are we really the unfriendliest place in America?
I don't know. Buzz off. The show's almost over. I don't know. I mean, you know, Oakland kind of surprises me. Oakland has a gigantic crime problem, but Oakland's in the sort of also part of the Bay Area, which, you know, is a very friendly place if
yeah,
you go out there.
It's unfriendly because you might get mugged.
I just wonder how scientific this survey is. Not to say that Connecticut people are friendly. They're not. but I sort of – it seemed like cities that maybe have kind of crime problems and other kinds of socioeconomic problems. I wondered whether this was really a rating of friendliness or just people's projections on to a certain kind of place.
Well, what do you think of this when you hear something like this, Christine?
Yeah. What are they judging this by? As somebody who is a transplant from Chicago, Illinois, I think that, you know, Hartford, Connecticut is a wonderful place. And I love New Haven, too. And I think that the people are friendly.
And see, Midwesterners are always friendly, but Midwesterners think everyone else is friendly. They're just nice by their nature. How about you, Chris?
I'd like to know where Trenton, New Jersey was in that survey. Trenton makes Hartford look like Paris.
Trenton?
Paris is not
Hartford
friendly either, though.
Look like Paris. Chris Keating is Capital Bureau Chief for the Hartford Current. Thank you so much, Chris, for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Christine Stewart. She's editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Get out of here.
Our program is produced by the lovely Lydia Brown and also the always helpful Tucker Ives with Katie Tolarski. This is Where We Live.